Welcome, everyone, to After Change You Can Believe In. Wally Shawn reads from his essays and discusses human nature with a communist, a benefit for revolution books. My name is Sansara Taylor, and I will be your host and moderator for this evening. And I wanted to begin by welcoming everyone on behalf of Revolution Books, and especially extending our appreciation and thanks to Wally Shawn for being part of this benefit to save Revolution Books, and to all of you for coming out and being part of this as well. Revolution Books is a truly unique bookstore. It's located on 26th Street in Manhattan. It is a center of revolutionary theory, of intellectual ferment, and on its shelves you can find art and literature, books on art and literature from around the world. You can find science and history, political economy and revolutionary theory, and a lot of things that you might find unexpected. Later in the program, I'll tell you more about Revolution Books and the campaign to save Revolution Books and to expand its influence and its role in this city and in political discourse more broadly. But for now, I'll just say that Revolution Books, its impact and its influence goes well beyond its four walls. The kind of conversation we're having here tonight is completely in line with the mission of Revolution Books. It is a bookstore that steps into the breach when there is a need to speak to the most vexing and important political and ideological questions of our times, when the atmosphere demands that radical and often uncomfortable truths be uttered in public, and when people hunger for the kind of wrangling and ideas that can be spurred and generated when you have people come together from different perspectives, sometimes clashing political viewpoints, but who share a concern for the state of the world and the future of humanity. This is the kind of dialogue we're having tonight, and I'm sure it will be stimulating and exciting, and we are going to hear from two very different perspectives. From Wally Shawn, he'll be reading. I'll just give you a sense of the format for the evening. We're going to begin with him giving a few remarks, reading from his book Essays, and after that, he will be joined on stage with a communist, Andy Z. And they'll have a conversation. And I'm going to be moderating this, perhaps asking a few questions, mainly listening intently like the rest of you. Before we invite the audience in to participate with comments or questions, I'm going to let you know a little bit more about Revolution Books, the efforts it's undertaking, the need to, save and expand the bookstore. And then we'll invite you guys to take part, to ask questions, make comments, and Andy and Wally will respond to you and to each other a bit further. All of this will take place in the course of about 2 hours. So before we get started, I just want to do the housekeeping. I want to remind people to turn off your cell phones or silence them. And that if you have not arranged prior permission with Revolution Books to refrain from taking photographs or recording. So with that, again, I'd like to welcome you to After Change You Can Believe In, Wally Shawn reads from his essays and discusses human nature with a communist. Wally Shawn's plays include The Fever, The Designated Mourner, Aunt Dan and Lemon, and most recently, Grasses of a Thousand Colors. He appears frequently on stage and television, and in many films, including My Dinner with Andre. His book, Essays, was published last spring and is available here tonight. Please join me in welcoming Wally Shawn.
Well, hello. So, can you hear me? Because I can't tell. And can't really see you. But I know you're there. So, I myself have benefited enormously from Revolution Books. When I was a troubled young man in the 1980s, a centrist who wondered if there might be something more and better out there. I frequently wandered into revolution books and browsed through the shelves and looked at books published by strange publishers. And I learned a lot of things in there. I bought some of those books and brought them home and studied them and became, well, I suppose I went from being confused to being disturbed. So, obviously, we all have different points of view, and we'll explore them tonight. And I think, you know, for many of us recovering centrists or people who hoped that maybe the system that we have could squeak through one more time, this is a rather troubling moment. Some of us waded through the Bush years hoping and believing that maybe there could be a redemption in store if some gentler and more decent people would take over the reins of the government. Many of us were pleased or even inspired by the decent fellow Obama who was elected. But sadly, only the most extreme maniacal Obama lovers are feeling cheerful about the situation today. Some people think that he is different or that he is not what he claimed that he would be, but taking it more seriously, it's not really about him. It's obviously about the whole system. Who is running things? Obviously, nobody we've ever met. People who are sitting somewhere rather like Uncle Scrooge in the comic books that I grew up on, diving off of a diving board into a swimming pool full of money. These are people we don't know, and yet they obviously are running things for their own benefit, and an awful lot of people don't even seem to quite recognize it yet, although more people are. Anyway, I'm going to read an essay in this book, which came out in September. It's relatively new. And this, I'm going to read an essay called The Quest for Superiority. And my hope is that this will be a good way to start a conversation. When I was 5 years old, I had a small room of my own with a record player and records and shelves full of books. I listened to music, I thought up different kinds of stories, and I played with paper and crayons and paint. Now I've grown up, and thank God things have mostly gone on as before. The paper, the stories, it's pretty much the same. I've been allowed to become a professional maker of art. I've become a writer, and I dwell in the mansion of arts and letters. When I was a child, I didn't know that the pieces of paper I used had been made by anybody. I certainly didn't know that almost everything I touched had been made by people who were poor, people who worked in factories or on farms or places like that. In fact, I'd never met anyone who worked in a factory or on a farm. I'd frequently met people who owned factories and farms because they lived all around us in the huge houses I could see from my window, although I wasn't aware then that the houses were huge because the people who lived in them paid very low salaries to their employees while paying themselves enormous sums. Our wealthy neighbors were really like the giants in a fantastic tale, giants who were superior to others because they could spin gold out of human suffering. Well, it turns out that I still live in the same neighborhood, because that's where the Mansion of Arts and Letters is located. So I still can see giants when I look out my window, and the funny thing is that pretty much all of us in the Mansion of Arts and Letters actually live off the money we get from these giants. Isn't that funny? You know, they buy the tickets to our shows, they buy our books and paintings, they support the universities where we teach, their gifts and grants, it all comes out of the gold they've spun. And we live with them. We share the streets with them. And we're all protected by the same cops. But you see, some of the people who don't live in the neighborhood, the ones our neighbors don't pay well or treat well, some of those people are out of control. They're so miserable, so desperate, they're out of their minds. They're very threatening. So it turns out we need more than cops. We actually have a large army as well, and a navy, and an air force, plus the FBI, Coast Guard, Central Intelligence Agency, and Marines. Oy! It turned out that simply in order to be secure and protect our neighborhood, we needed an empire. Some of us who live in the Mansion of Arts and Letters are a bit touchy about our relationship to our wealthy neighbors. Bob, for example. He's a painter who lives down the hall from me. He refuses to bow to them when they pass him in the street. But you know, they buy his paintings all the same. For me, though, it's my relationship with the poor people outside the neighborhood that I sometimes brood about in the middle of the night. It's the fact that so many of them are in agony that's in a way thought-provoking. One evening last week, a friend and I went to a somewhat inexpensive restaurant, and the waiter who served us was in such a state of agitation or anxiety about God knows what that he didn't even look at us. And so I was thinking about the fact that in more expensive restaurants, the staff is usually trained to focus their attention on the pleasure of the diners, not on their own problems. In fact, the waiters in more expensive restaurants are invited to be friendly, amusing, to make funny remarks about their lives, to let us diners get to know them a little. But in the most expensive restaurants, the really fancy ones, we don't get to know the waiters at all. The waiters in those restaurants don't make funny remarks. They do their work with such discretion that they're barely noticed, and people compliment them by saying that they're unobtrusive. Actually, that's quite a good word for all those people whom we don't know and don't think about much, but who serve us and make the things we need and whose lives we actually dominate. The unobtrusives. And the interesting thing I've noticed is that in those very expensive restaurants, we don't talk with the waiters, but we enjoy their presence enormously. We certainly wouldn't want them to be replaced by robots or by conveyor belts that would carry our food to us while we sat in the dining room completely alone. No, we want them there, those silent waiters, these unobtrusives. It's obviously a characteristic of human beings that we like to feel superior to others. But our problem is that we're not superior. We like the sensation of being served by others and feeling superior to them. But if we're forced to get to know the people who serve us, we quickly see that they're in fact just like us. And then we become uncomfortable and scared, because if we can see that we're just the same, well, they might too. And if they did, they might become terribly, terribly angry, because why should they be serving us? So that's why we prefer not to talk to waiters. A king feels the very same way, I'd have to imagine. He doesn't really want to get to know his subjects, but he nonetheless enjoys the fact that he has them. He finds it enjoyable to be told, "Your Majesty, you have 10,000 subjects." And in fact, he finds it even more enjoyable to be told, "Your Majesty, you have 1,000,000 subjects," even though he may never see them. The subjects are in the background of his life. They're in the background of his life, and yet they provide the meaning of his life. Without his subjects, he wouldn't be king. Some people like to feel superior because once they were made to feel inferior. Others, including myself, were told constantly in their early days that they were superior, and now find themselves to be hopelessly addicted. So, if I get into a conversation, for example, with a person who knows nothing about me, I immediately start to experience a sort of horrible tension, as if my head were being squashed, because the person I'm talking to is unaware of my superiority. Well, I have at my disposal an arsenal of indicators of superiority that I can potentially deploy. I can casually allude to certain schools I attended, to my artistic work, to the elegant street on which I grew up. But if, by analogy to some of those tantric exercises one reads about, I attempt to follow the counterintuitive path of not revealing any of these clues, well, it's simply interesting to observe that I can rarely manage to hold out for as long as 10 minutes before forcing my interlocutor to learn the truth about me. Weirdly, it turns out to be possible for a person to feel superior because somehow connected to them, someone has been raised up above others. A friend, an acquaintance, a parent, a child. And the connection can be even vaguer than that. I have to admit, I take a certain pride in Gustav Mahler's symphonies. After all, he was Jewish, and so am I. And Emily Dickinson was born in the United States, just like me. Incidentally, one unmistakable way to know you're superior to someone is to beat them up. And just as I feel rather distinguished if a writer from the United States wins the Nobel Prize, I also feel stronger and more important because my country's army happens to dominate the world. The king doesn't need to meet his subjects in order to enjoy his dominion over them. And I don't need to go to Iraq to know that there are people all over the world, a great number of quiet unobtrusives, who experience a feeling of stomach-turning terror when they see soldiers wearing the uniform of my country approaching their door in the middle of the night. Now, let's admit that some of the rougher people who seem to thrive in our country, people like Dick Cheney, for example, may perhaps take actual pleasure from the thought of our country's soldiers smashing in the door of some modest house in some godforsaken region of the planet, forcing a family to huddle on the floor, administering kicks in the face to anyone they like. Perhaps there may even be a modest clerk in a bank in Kansas or a quiet housewife on a farm in Idaho who feels a bit of enjoyment at a thought like that. But what bothers me more is that although I have nothing but contempt for imperial adventures, I've marched in the streets to demonstrate for peace, and I don't make it a practice to wink or joke about the brutal actions of brutal men, I can't deny that in spite of myself, I derive some sense of superiority from being a citizen of a country that can act brutally with impunity and can't be stopped. I feel quite different from the way I know I would feel if I were a citizen of Grenada, Mauritius, or the Tongan Islands. My feeling of superiority and the sense of well-being that comes from that increases with the number of poor people on the planet whose lives are dominated by me or my proxies and whom I nonetheless can completely ignore. I like to be reminded of those poor people, the unobtrusives, and then I like to be reminded of my lack of interest in them. For example, while I eat my breakfast each morning, I absolutely love to read my morning newspaper, because in the first few pages, the newspaper tells me how my country treated all the unobtrusives on the day before. Deaths, beatings, torture, what have you. And then, as I keep turning the pages, the newspaper reminds me how unimportant the unobtrusives are to me. And it tries to tempt me in its articles on shirts to consider different shirts that I might want to wear. And then it goes on as I turn the pages to try to coax me into sampling different forms of cooking and then to experience different plays or films, different types of vacations. It's become second nature to me to use the quiet crushing of the unobtrusives as a sort of almost inaudible background music to my daily life. Like those people who grow bizarrely nervous if they don't have a recording of something or other quietly playing on their sound system at dinner time, we've become dependent over the course of decades on hearing the faint murmur of cries and groans as we eat, shop, and live. How will the world change? Believe me, those who are now unobtrusive have their own ideas about how the situation might improve. But in the middle of the night, I wonder, can we in the Mansion of Arts and Letters play a part? Could we reduce the destructiveness of the people we know Could we possibly use the dreams we create to lure our friends in another direction? Because it's valuable to remember that the feeling of superiority is not the only source of human satisfaction. Imperial dreams are not the only dreams. I've known people, for example, who've derived satisfaction from collecting seashells. And sometimes I think of a woman I knew a long time ago who seemed to be terribly happy, although her life consisted of not much more than getting up each day, playing with the cat, reading a mystery, eating an agreeable sandwich for lunch, then taking a walk in the afternoon. No wealthy giant eating dishes costing hundreds of dollars could ever have enjoyed a meal more than this woman seemed to enjoy her simple sandwiches. So what was her secret? And what about Edgar, who gets such pleasure out of working as a nurse? Or Tom, who finds such nourishment teaching children in school? Jane's need for superiority seems fully satisfied if a friend admires one of her drawings, and Edna's overjoyed if she wins at cards. People can make a life, it seems, out of love, out of gardening, out of sex, friendship, the company of animals, the search for enlightenment, the enjoyment of beauty. Wait. Isn't that our particular province in the mansion of arts and letters? Beauty can be important in a person's life. And people beguiled by the beautiful are less dangerous to others than those obsessed by the thought of supremacy. If an afternoon of reading poetry has given me a feeling of profound well-being, I don't then need to go out into the street and seek satisfaction by strangling prostitutes. Art can be central in a person's life. If the art we create is beautiful enough, will people be so drawn to looking at it that they'll leave behind their quest for power? Beauty is really more enjoyable than power. A poem really is more enjoyable than an empire, because a poem doesn't hate you. The defense of privilege, the center of our lives for such a long time, is grim, exhausting. We're exhausted from holding on to things, exhausted from trying not to see those unobtrusive people we're kicking away, whose suffering is actually unbearable to us. In the mansion of arts and letters, we live like children, running and playing up and down the hallways all day and all night. We fill room after room with the things we make. After our deaths, we'll leave behind our poems, drawings, and songs made for our own pleasure, and we won't know if they'll be allowed to help in the making of a better world. Thank you.
Reached the portion of the evening where we are going to have a dialogue. I'm going to maybe scoot forward just a little bit. And maybe you could scoot back just a few inches.
Okay.
So that we can... No, not you. That way you guys can see each other and I can see you. We can all talk. Is that okay? You guys... Okay.
Very good. All right.
Okay. So, Andy Z has now joined us. Andy is the spokesperson for Revolution Books. He's been behind the revitalization of the bookstore, He's also a longtime revolutionary and been very active in the revolutionary movement since the 60s. He's worked in the arts, he's been a communist, and he is a writer for Revolution Newspaper. So I want to welcome Andy Z. So to begin the evening, I would like to invite Andy to make a few opening remarks, comments off of the essay that you just heard or other things to frame the discussion this evening.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you so much, Wally, for doing this, both for raising the question the way you've raised it and for also doing this on behalf of Revolution Books. I think we can certainly say that there certainly is a role for people in the mansion of arts and letters to influence the world. I think that was our experience in the beginning of this. I also want to thank Sansara for doing this, moderating this, and also the staff of Revolution Books for all the work that went into producing this program and the publicity and the great posters and the video crews and everybody else. Wally said that in this current situation, let's talk about human nature and with a communist, and that is tonight, me. But I want to say some of you have probably read some communism and others maybe not so much. But if you haven't had a chance to check out the new cutting-edge synthesis of communism developed by Bob Avakian, you will not know where exactly I'm coming from. So hopefully tonight, in what I'm able to bring to this conversation, you'll get a sense of what's really a new synthesis of communism, continuing that project, but with really some significant differences in philosophy, conception of a socialist society, as well as in questions of strategy. So the questions posed, the quest for superiority, and it just occurs to me right off the top that here's two guys who grew up in New York. We're talking in New York, and our New York song is, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. So apparently there's a very big urge to feel superior, and it's around and about in the culture. So the question of how should we talk about this? Well, one thing I was thinking of from our conversation the way over here is I was going to ask this young woman who's working on the camera to zoom in very closely to just Wally's head and my head, if that's possible, in one shot, and there'd be the illusion that you and I are just a couple of guys talking, and somehow or other she found a way into the room to talk to us. But then if you would spin that lens back and take in everything else, you'd find out that this was a deceit, a falsehood. We're not having a conversation. We're actually sitting here in front of 200 people trying to convince you of one thing or another, and certainly to convince you to support Revolution Books. And but in that, pulling the lens in and pulling the lens out is kind of how I want to come at this conversation. What is behind these human nature? What causes it? What is our nature after all? And I was also thinking of one part of human nature that I happen to like a lot is eating. I mean, it's not just human nature. Every living thing also likes to eat. But if we were to walk out the door and go a block south and a couple blocks west, we'd find ourselves in Whole Foods. And for those, I guess everybody here, it's probably experienced that. It's almost unavoidable now. But you go in there and there's a tremendous theatrical display of fruits. And first you'd hit the Indian steam table and the Chinese steam table and then the burritos. And then I have a particular fondness for bananas. We would get some bananas. But if I should be one of these 6 million people currently in the U.S. who are surviving only on food stamps, with no other source of income, and should it be the end of the month, and I didn't have money to pay for this, I would soon encounter an employee of Whole Foods who would inform me I have to pay, and should I persist in this, then indeed the people you spoke of from the New York City Police Department would show up, and the only place I would make it to is the largest penal colony in the world, which is Rikers Island. So right there, a basic need and desire confronts a whole bunch of other things. One thing that occurs is, how did that food get there? What went into bringing this food into that supermarket? You know, one thing, if you speak about the banana that may have come from Colombia, and you've written about this, and I think it's really incredibly presented in The Fever and in some of these essays, there's a whole set of social relations that went into getting that banana grown. There was land taken, people employed, people enslaved, lawyers hired, including our current Attorney General, Eric Holder, who was the lawyer for United Fruit for many years, particularly when it was under a lot of investigation. So all of this would come into, comes into play when we talk about and look at our desires. Now, it so happens that people read The New Yorker recently, and there was a profile of John Mackey in it, who's the CEO of Whole Foods. He apparently doesn't believe that we have any intrinsic right to health care or to eat, but he's apparently very passionate about the intrinsic right to make money. And in fact, he was very, very pissed off recently about the idea that people see some sort of antagonism between making money and doing good, because his philosophy is that the more money you make, the more good you can do. But even the good writer from The New Yorker, a fellow named, I think it's Paumgarten, made the point that this is actually an imperial display that's in front of you. So anyway, I think this is a way I'm just trying to illustrate that there's a lot of social relations that go into the expression of our desires. But I also want to say that when I look at this tremendous cornucopia of food at Whole Foods, another thought comes into your head. That for the first time in human history, there's the potential, actually really the actuality of being able to feed and clothe and house everybody on the planet except for one barrier, which is that nothing gets produced in this planet unless some capitalist or group of capitalists can make a profit for it. That's what stands between the people on food stamps, let alone the person in Somalia or some other part of the planet, from being able to eat. And so this is something in terms of why or why I'm coming from, that we need a revolution to change this. It doesn't have to be this way. There was a time in human history when it did. There wasn't enough abundance. There wasn't enough technology for that. But that's no longer the case, except for this one barrier. But I think we should talk about human nature. And I think there are two things that I guess I would say about that do have to do with something that makes us particularly human, different than any other species. One is that we have the ability to understand the world. And clearly from that essay, through art. I mean, clearly a work of art such as this essay and certainly the plays, you can come away with a whole different understanding of reality. We also understand it in terms of talking and analysis and political theory and history. These are all ways that we are unique as a species in being able to understand the world that we live in. And another thing that's particularly unique about our species and our nature is that we have the ability to transform our nature and to transform the world. We can act on it. And clearly our human nature has changed over the tens of thousands of years that there's been civilization, and while there's gradual changes that happen, there's also changes that happen in big leaps when whole ways that people look at the world suddenly change and exist in a new way. And this is why Marx actually said that the whole history, that all of human history, is nothing but the continuous transformation of human nature. So I think these are some things we can get into. I would like to talk about this quest for superiority and what is it? Where does it come from? Who feels this? And why do they feel this? And how can we change it? And also, you'd say that imperial dreams aren't the only dreams we have. And I think that's also true. And so I think we should spend some time to sort of exploring, well, how do we have those imperial dreams more characterize who we are than these need to look down on each other.
Obviously, we'd like the situation to change so that everybody who didn't have any food could go into Whole Foods and take what he needed, and yet the guy who owns it feels that he has to set the rule that without payment, people aren't allowed to take the food. Now, I don't, I'm not really an expert, to put it mildly, on primitive societies, but certainly there are, there seem to be groups of people, even in my own experience, and it's probably more true in primitive societies, that people can share and can cooperate and find it appropriate. Even a group of actors putting on a play instinctively share food if it's lunchtime, and some people don't have, they didn't bring any lunch. It's just absolutely inevitable that the one who has brought his little container of rice and beans is going to give half of that to the next guy. Now the question is whether the, how do you, I mean, the, I suppose different social systems have different opinions about how to keep the human drive for superiority in a recessive state, and the human capacity for empathy in a dominant state. And obviously, the fear that those of us who are worried about communism would have is that the leaders of the revolution might themselves be bedeviled by a desire for superiority, and might exercise that over even the people on whose behalf they've led the revolution. This is the anxiety and the concern, particularly when those who were formerly the owners of Whole Foods are trying to regain their grasp on it and might need to be slapped down. But then those who are doing the slapping might grow overexcited about themselves, just like Dick Cheney. That's the worry. And I suppose different systems of different concepts of change that we have are intended to deal with that. I mean, obviously the people who founded the United States tried to invent a system where nobody could get too powerful, but under the current circumstance, the rich are able to propagandize people and buy off people to such an extent that
they have all the power.
Well, let me just, take a second here. One thing I do always have I hear what you say. I want to come to your main argument, but I do have to say these founders of the U.S. is something we do have to confront. I mean, there isn't a politician that doesn't go up and speak in praise of the founders, and we just do have to really take an honest look at who these people were and what they did, and they're, we are talking about oligarchs who formed the original Constitution. This is, black people were 3/5 of a human being. This was a country founded on slavery. All these kinds, this whole history of a nation founded on genocide of the Native American people, the theft of their land, all of this. We need to look at the founding of this country in that political context. But that still gets to the question then of why, what kind of society do you need where the people who do come in power, who do in a socialist society, in a communist revolution, that would represent the people now on the bottom of society, the people who've been locked out of not only material wealth, but being able to participate in all spheres of life, art, intellectual life, all of this is kept out from the majority of people within this country, and actually on a world scale, it's really, really extensive. And so would these people and the people who represent them, what would keep them from being, as the Who song put it, old boss, same as the new boss? What would prevent them? What kind of, can people change in a certain sense? I think that's one thing I want to kind of speak to. There's a whole range of what kind of government do you need, how should it be set up, and all of this. But I think that how people change, and can the people on the bottom of society not be motivated by revenge, as justified as that might be in a certain sense, in a narrow confines of, well, you've had your go, now it's my turn. If that's the revolution we have, well, then indeed, we'll simply replicate what we've already got, and it wouldn't have been worth going through it altogether. And the vision that of the kind of society we're trying to bring to being will not be that. But I was thinking about this question of change, and can people change, and trying to prepare for this, and instead decided to watch a movie. In the bookstore, we showed this movie, Trouble the Water, it's a very moving film. I think it won a number of awards in 07 or 08, and it's about, for those who haven't seen it, it's about Katrina. And what's really, why am I telling this story? Because I went off and watched the movie last night. It actually has to do with, can human nature change, and can people rise above feelings of revenge? And it's about Katrina, but it focuses on this couple, Kimberly and Scott. And Kimberly is an aspiring rapper, and Scott is a gangster. But Kimberly has a video camera, and she starts videotaping. She's apparently always doing these things, and when the storm was announced, she starts videotaping the neighborhood. And at a certain point, they don't have money to leave, so they're there. And it's harrowing. It's absolutely harrowing, because you're in the house, it's raining, the water's rising, the levees break, and it cuts back and forth to the news, and then all of a sudden they're up on the second floor, and then they're in the attic, and you're seeing all this unfold before you. And literally, they're just, it's horrific. But Scott then goes down and gets a punching bag, and he's walking and swimming through the streets, saving people. And he's doing this with another gangbanger. And these are two guys who would have been at each other's throat but the day before. And they're faced with an extraordinary new situation, and they become different people. And this is a film that I can't commend to you enough. That's just the transformation that one gets forged in this incredible storm, and then there's the whole aftermath and the back and forth and what they go up against with the state. That I could take the whole 40 minutes to recount this, but you see people whose lives in a new situation become different people. And Scott talks about this. He says, look, I didn't go to high school. I could make $500 a day selling crack out here on the corner. But he hated his life. He hated it. But in this new situation, which then transformed a whole lot of social relations for them, he became a new person. And then the story goes on. They go to the He leads people blocks and blocks through waist-deep water to get to the U.S. naval base, and what happens? They turn their guns on them and say, you can't go here. And this is a naval base that was closed by the government. So it's empty with barracks. And then they have to walk back across town. See the movie. But the point is that here you get a sense of people who you think are these people who would naturally, if you encountered them, you know, in their normal times, would be forced by circumstance to try and take from you as they would. But in this new situation, they become different people. And I think in terms of this fear of communism being that, I think we have to see that we need a different kind of society where you could have a whole different kind of social relations and background where people could transform. And then we could talk some about forms and whatnot, but why don't I stop there?
Well, I think it is hard for any of us to imagine people changing, although a wonderful fact about being senile, or at least old, is... there are these memories that inevitably you accrue of how people really were different. I mean, in different situations. Obviously, I mean, one that your example brings to mind is, you know, thinking of people who are incredibly desperate and poor. In the 60s, they were so much more political in the United States than they are today, as far as I, a privileged white guy, would know. The things that, I mean, if you listen to the speeches of Malcolm X, or, you know, members of the Black Panther Party, they're so shocking that you sort of think society could hardly withstand more than a couple of years of this. Something would have had to change dramatically. And in the event, what changed was that those people were killed and they stopped making those speeches. And somehow, people who were poor and desperate found hope in, as you say, gangsterism or crime, rather than in a hope for political change. But it is hard for us to actually imagine that human beings in their essence could be any different from what they are. A story that I have recently heard that I found meaningful because I'm quite... well, obviously, art-oriented. The conductor Simon Rattle has done, and sort of, I suppose you'd call it an experiment with children Berlin, and he also did it here. He conducts the Berlin Philharmonic, and he has a friend who is great at teaching children to dance, and he collected a big pile of cash and enabled a group of maybe 100 school children from, he found the poorest neighborhoods in Berlin and in New York, and he's done this in, I think, originally in, I think, Liverpool, maybe, where he comes from. And he got them to work on a dance based on Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. And he worked it out with the school authorities so that they could spend an incredible amount of time working on this dance. They could cut all their classes for most of a year and work after school. I don't say cut all their classes, but cut many of their classes and work after school to work on this dance. And the students became very, very familiar with Stravinsky's music. And they came to love Stravinsky's music. Not only could they dance in a way that seemed improbable and impossible, but what amazed me more was how involved they became in a piece of music that actually, as recently as the time it was written, 100 years ago, a lot of people found, even very, very sophisticated people, found impossible to understand. And I do feel that, and I've been a school teacher, and I do feel that even though I have often said, well, I have no talent for mathematics, or, you know, I was no good at science or whatever, I actually don't believe that. I actually think that every child is quite capable of doing science, mathematics, music, and I think I would go so far as to believe that every baby could not only, if given the right conditions, appreciate Stravinsky's work, but could do something comparable himself. And yet, as things are currently organized, people are divided into classes at birth, and 98% of them stay in their class. And the potential Stravinsky is told, well, you unfortunately cannot be a Stravinsky. You can't even listen to Stravinsky. You are going to be a laborer, or more unfortunately, we don't have a job for you. You will be a criminal. And you know, I don't think that Andy and I would have the same beliefs about how you climb out of the nightmarish world that we're in into a better one. But it's, I'm surprised at how little I think about the question. And I think, like a lot of people, I just get up each day and I read the newspaper and I think, these are terrible things. What can we do about them? And even that is defeating. But I don't even get to thinking, how could the whole system be changed so that these babies could realize their full potential? And I mean, I have to say that, I have the greatest respect for those who are thinking about the question. Even if I am concerned about the answer that one or another of them may come up with, I almost don't think about it at all from one end of the year to the next, and I find that so monstrous, really, because those lives of those babies are being wasted, even if they're not being actually starved and killed.
Well, I have to say, I find that very, very, very moving, including in terms of, just the relationship between people starving and what those babies could do. And we are at a point now with 1.25 billion people a day away from starvation. And the first thing that happens when a child is malnourished is they lose the ability to play. And when I say that there's the productive capacity to feed and house and clothe all the people in the world, it includes this tremendous, wasted, squandered human potential that exists in the world today. Now, it's true, to really change things and to make it possible for all those children, for all of those children to contribute, you do have to have a new society and state power. And I know that there's this question that you pose, can you be a moral person and hold state power? Will it make you into who you don't want to be and what you were actually fighting against? But there's another way to look at the question, too. In today's world, can you actually be a moral person and not, or put it this way, be a moral person and rule out of order the possibility of going for a new society ahead of time, just because that within that seizing of a new state power and forging that new state power, there's the possibility of reverting back to what came before. And see, that's something I think that I don't accept. I think that we actually then have to take a deep look at the world as it is and find the ways and study the previous revolutions, understanding what they accomplished, what they were up against, and indeed examining very closely where they went wrong, both in terms of the methodology and the policies that they undertook. And these are things that we have to explore. We shouldn't be afraid of them. But if that becomes the rationale for living in the world as it is, and then the most we can do is be a moral opposition to things remaining as they are, well, that I don't find that acceptable. But the question still is posed of how, when you do need a state power that is going to keep people from coming back and then resetting up the same society you had before. And without, I don't think this is the evening to get into all what these various revolutionary societies have been in, but this was a very big problem that Mao Zedong identified, the need to continue the revolution and have a revolution within the revolution to prevent the restoration of capitalism. And after he died, what he was afraid of indeed did happen. And I would say that along with the counter, what I would say really is counterinsurgency to the Black Liberation Movement and the revolutionary movement in this country in the 60s and around the world, is the more, in one sense, central fact in that was the defeat of the revolution in China. Because that had a tremendous effect. Because there wouldn't have been a Black Panther Party had there not been a revolutionary China. That was where they took their inspiration for that there's a whole different way the world could be. And without that question being in the air, then all the political discourse is way suppressed. Political imagination is stifled and very limited. You're forced to trying to figure out how to provide a micro loan to a few people over here, and never mind the majority of humanity and how that's going to all get swallowed up. And so this is something, you know, that we at Revolution Books are trying to do a lot to kind of lift the lid off of social imagination by putting revolution back in the air. I realize I need to also speak a little bit to what kind of society. I just want to say that the new society does have to suppress, in a certain sense, those who would try and restore the old society. But that's actually not the essence of what we're trying to do. In other words, we are in this problem. We have this. Here's the situation. You have the unobtrusives. I thought that was an amazing word. Amazing word. It kind of struck me again. This is a little bit off topic, but when I saw Avatar and I saw these colonialists going in there, and what are they mining but unobtainium? It made me right away think of your unobtrusives, who are the ones mining the unobtainium, but that's an aside. But nonetheless, there are these unobtrusives who have been socialized to a certain extent to be artfully and silently in the background practicing a self-abnegation, you know, just invisibles. How do we bring all those people into political life? That's actually the problem of the revolution. And you do need a society that has tremendous vibrancy, has a lot of contention, ideological contention, has a tremendous role for art and for the life of the mind, and is changing every sphere of society, from the educational system to the healthcare system to how things are produced and to how things are governed, so that increasingly you're bringing more and more people into a process of trying to eliminate all the inequalities and that have existed in the previous society, and actually all the traditional thinking that has accrued over these thousands of years of living in societies that are dominated by one group or another, and fundamentally, as you say, well, in classes. So,
I know, to use an example that might seem, well, you may say what an indication of how bourgeois he is to use this example. But I've been on many juries in New York City, not the criminal ones. I always talk my way out of that, because I just say that I don't think anybody should be in prison, and they usually let me off. But I've been on quite a few civil cases where there are people from educated backgrounds, and there are people who have very little education, and who ordinarily don't consider themselves intellectual workers. When given the responsibility of being on the jury and being treated with a certain respect, in my experience, in every case, people rose. Didn't take them long to accept the dignity that was offered to them, and indeed to challenge the opinions and observations of the supposedly more sophisticated and educated people on the jury. And so I suppose my leaning personally is towards something with less involvement of a powerful state, in which individuals could somehow be more and more encouraged to bring their better nature to the surface, and could somehow in a more more democratic and cooperative way run things. I mean, we're speaking about something that isn't happening in front of our eyes, and it's very hard to talk about. Yet, we need to talk about it and think about it, because change actually does happen in history, and usually when no one expects it, and usually faster than people expect it. And friends, to use double meaning of the word, we better have thought about these issues.
You know, even in our experience of being of the age we are, and you reference the 1960s, you can see the all that went into creating that period of time when, unfortunately, there wasn't a revolution. One might have been possible. There was a moment there when things were really up in the air. Even Kissinger admitted that there was that the governing classes did not have the swing in society, that they had lost political initiative and were largely delegitimized, at least in a certain sense, not in their, in terms of their armed might, which they then did reassert. But at that time, you think about, you know, the aim of communism is to get rid of classes and to get rid of governments. Yes, that is where this is going, the withering away of the state. The process through a long historical period where the function of a state to enforce the rule of one class or another, where that's no more. But the problem is, to get there, you do have to go through a whole process. And if we look back at the 1960s, none of us would have been as radical as we became, those who became radical, and others who were influenced in different ways, had it not been for the fact that the Vietnamese were kicking the butt of the U.S. That kind of, at least, the only lottery I ever won was the draft lottery. And it did send me to college, or make that much more attractive to me at that time. But, you know, that did focus the attention, and it certainly focused the attention of the troops. But that wasn't all that went into that. There was a revolution in music. There was rock and roll. There was a cultural revolution in terms of, there was a cultural revolution in China, which had a big impact. But I'm speaking about people letting their hair grow long and challenging all conventional mores. All spheres of society were challenging the way things were. And there was a moment when there was possibility. That isn't what exists right now in terms of the social climate in the U.S. But the conditions that could give rise to it do exist. The kind of contradictions that we are facing, the kind of hardships that people are facing, we were talking before about the war. The U.S. under Obama is now in five countries, five wars: Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, and now Yemen. And that's just what they're telling us about. So this is unacceptable. And I think you then start seeing where you do need a state. Look, you wouldn't have, even though things are still what they are in the world, you wouldn't have had the desegregation that you had in this, even in, within this country, without state power being administered to enforce laws that were the product of struggle as well as necessities that the U.S. felt they had to do in relationship to the rest of the world, in terms of there was a large upsurge of struggles against colonialism, and this segregation in the U.S. didn't look so good. But even so, you couldn't make those changes without having a power that backed the people up in the changes that they wanted to make. That's going to be that's something you need to do in a new society as well. And again, this is that's a whole big topic, which, you know, I do think, you know, is something that people do have to talk about. And not to talk about it is to say, you know what, the world's just fine. Let me hope that, all right, this last savior didn't work. Maybe the next one who's going to come over here, maybe that one will work. It's not going to happen.
Yeah. I certainly don't I'm one who actually does think Obama is a good guy. And I don't expect that there would be a nicer guy who will be elected next time or the next time. It isn't really about that. And I think it is actually, a pretty devastating thought, even to me, and I have crept somewhat far away from my origins as a sort of centrist who believed in the Democratic Party. I've crept pretty far away from it, and yet I'm still myself shocked to think, yes, this may be the most decent guy that we're going to have, and yet, his ability to change the system is either completely blocked or he has been magically brainwashed and transformed by walking into that building. It doesn't matter which is true. Both are probably true. The reality is the same people who were running the country 2 years ago are running it now, and the situation is sort of unbearable.
So I'd like to open the floor for questions to the speakers. I just want to give a sense to get who all wants to go ahead. You can start things off.
Well, first I want to thank you for having this. And you were both so provocative, and it was really exciting. A couple of things were running through my mind as you were speaking.
Hold the mic up a little more.
Okay, is this better? All right. Okay, better? Mm-hmm. All right. I should know how to do this. Anyway, it was the question of superiority. And it had to do with feeling superior about being intelligent and feeling superior about being moral. And how that leads us to the us versus them. And I think that these things create it kills the revolution at the beginning. Because I was thinking earlier that we need to find new words, because communism is passé, in my humble estimation, and centrism and all of that. I think it's about transformation. I think you said it, change, instead of change, is rehumanizing. And the people that are dying, they're not just the hungry. You know, the oppressed are dying just as much as the oppressors. Or rather, the oppressed are dying, and we see it, and we're moved by it. But the oppressors are also dying. Their spirit is dead. So it's about transformation. And if we see it as transformation and rehumanization, perhaps there won't be as much of a resistance. Because it's about all of us, brothers and sisters. And I just wanted to make a little comment that dialogues are happening in churches. I hang around a lot in churches and bars. And I'd like to volunteer to talk to the bar the way I hang out, to have a grassroots conversation on a Sunday afternoon. You know, we just got to go outside the paradigm. And, you know, because I wear this label, then, and I have to correct you a little bit. I don't think that the black movement was 100% just because of the Chinese revolution, because otherwise we'd still have slavery. I think it's something in the human spirit that if you, you know, if your foot is on your back long enough, you're going to eventually get up and, you know, get the person with whose foot is on your back off of you. And that's why Obama is dangerous, even though I love him, because we feel that there's been changes, so we become anesthetized. But I think that's enough for now.
There was a lot.
Yeah, I mean, you said so many things. I don't know. But I'll just stick with the first thing that you said. Obviously, the tendency for people to... Well, the tendency for people to want to be more intelligent and more moral than they were before is a good thing. But if you feel you're making progress, you might become dangerous. It's true. And I mean, you know, and I know that, you know, we discussed this the other day, that when you talk about revolution and you talk about certain people leading in that, the danger is obvious, that those who have led the revolution successfully had to feel in the course of doing so, well, we are the good guys. We're in the right. And if they then are powerful, they may still be thinking, well, I'm the same person, so I'm still one of the good guys. And I was right last year, so I must still be right. And when people oppose me, they should be suppressed. This is obviously a danger, and this is why I personally am afraid of concepts like vanguard and dictatorship of the proletariat, because I'm worried about those tendencies, which basically come down to thinking I'm more intelligent and I'm more moral. Which you might have been last Tuesday, compared to somebody else, you know. But it can change very fast. And you can use that belief that you're more intelligent and more moral to say, well, it should be my say-so and not yours, which gets dangerous.
Well, these are small questions. Look, the essential question is, what is your morality? What is your morality that's making you feel, if we can just take the intelligence and put it aside for a second, what is your morality, and what's your method by which you're trying to do that? What is the content actually of this leadership, and what's the necessity for it? I mean, we should really speak about these things, and they, let me try and speak to it briefly and really only indicate some answers, because these are obviously tremendous questions. But one, the communist morality really, as I think it really goes back to Marx, but that is got lost a bit in there, and it's been really revitalized by Avakian a lot here. But it does go back to a basic point, that what are we trying to do? What do we want to do that we have a morality that corresponds to? Well, one thing is we're really trying to change the class distinctions that exist in society. And those class distinctions get reflected in how things get produced, in the ways people relate to each other. We're trying to change the social relations that correspond to this, the divisions between men and women, between, your point, different nationalities, all the inequalities that accrue to class-divided society, and all the traditional ideas that correspond to this and reinforce people's thinking. Our morality is based on trying to, one, make this known, so that there's something people can judge you by. Well, it's not just because you say so. I mean, in fact, it's a problem of a revolution. It's a big problem. If you make a revolution, you're not going to make a revolution by yourself. It's because millions and tens of millions and hundreds of millions of people want change. And so they're going to say, well, you're pretty good because you made the revolution. And the problem then presents itself to you of how do you actually start involving all of them in this process, and do they have anything to judge you by? And that just, I want to just indicate that one of the real hallmarks of what has been, what's new in this new communism, is putting communism on a much more scientific footing. And not because, and have there been tendencies of, well, we're communists, we're good guys, we're for, you know, the emancipation of all humanity, therefore, everything we do represents that. And you can get into a tautology that gets you right back where you started. No, there has to be a scientific spirit of interrogating ourselves, and inviting the interrogation of others. This is not a closed system. And so this putting communism on a more scientific footing and training a lot of people, I say training, really making this known and having people engage in that, is part of how you actually do prevent and the people being blindly led. But let's also be very honest here. Right now, there's a relatively small minority of people who even really understand what the hell we're talking about here. Well, it's just a fact. It's just a fact. Most people are locked out of political life. My God, if people put up with all this, you don't think they're thinking about everything else that's going on. Even very intelligent people, as you said, and I don't think this is exceptional. Actually, I think you are exceptional. Pay a lot more attention than you give yourself credit for, at least tonight. But a lot of people don't. And even of the educated classes, but certainly the people on the bottom who've been locked out of intellectual life. So you make a revolution, it'd be very easy to say, oh, okay, now everybody has an everybody, whatever you want to do. Well, in a heartbeat, you'd be right back to the previous society. You'd be voted right out of office in a minute, because people don't understand all the ways that the world works. And so you have to have a process, you have to have a society where people are themselves becoming to understand the objectives of this revolution, and its morality is consistent with trying to work their way through transforming all these ways that people produce things, all these uprooting all these old oppressive social relations and changing their thinking in accord with that. And if people understand that, then there's a way that they can judge you. There's a way they can judge you. That's what you want. You want to put out what we, you know, there is a point back from Marx and communists disdain to conceal their views. We're not concealing anything. Our agenda is open, not hidden. And in part because that's how people themselves can come in on this process and hold us accountable and change the world, and in so doing, change their own thinking.
Yes, if everybody's thinking could change first, and then as a group, they could take over the running of the world, we'd be better off. I mean, it's people can disagree over whether that could happen.
But you just say one thing, but that the humor in it is that, of course, they can't. That people don't all come to understand things all at once. The danger here is that People can't all come to understand all of that all at once, and certainly not under this society. And this is why you need leadership. You need leadership. And there's going to be leadership of one kind or another. The question is, what's the content of that leadership, and how are they actually leading that enables other people to get in on it? Just to put it simply and...
Okay, now we're going to be really rushed and try to get in a few questions. Wow. Right here in the middle of this woman in the magenta, maybe?
Hi, I'm a teaching artist also. I teach at Boricua College, and I'm a theater director and producer, and we heard about your event because we came to Revolution Books to present our idea about a dance operetta based on Jack London's The Iron Heel. It's a socialist novel that was written a little over 100 years ago, and we produced it last fall, and it was really great to be able to come to Revolution Books and share these ideas with so many people who really supported the work and were interested in it. And I have sort of a compound question, I guess, for Wally Shawn. I've heard that in this time of economic crisis that theater is having a resurgence, and I was wondering if you have, as a theater maker, feel that that's the case. And I mean, theater is just such a wonderful way for the creative spark that you've been extolling tonight to be able to have expression without any really external support as far as financial support. All it takes is human beings, and I think that's one of the things I like about theater. And I'm wondering if you see that kind of spark coming through in today's theater, and if you feel that there's a place where creative and progressive theater is going on, and if so, where?
I'm unfortunately really too preoccupied with myself to know, honestly, the answer to the question. I mean, it is a marvelous thing about theater that it's very, very easy for a bunch of people to get together in a room and read a play or put on a play. Compared to some things that people could do. In a way, it's even easier if you have the talent to write a book. Art is bizarrely inexpensive to create compared to, you know, even the simplest products like a shoe or a sock. And I don't, you know, it is a thought-provoking reality. But I don't know whether, you know, there is a ferment in theater. I have no idea.
I'd like to go to another question. Wow. I'm intrigued. Go ahead. You stood up.
You're talking about the content of the leadership and what the leadership we might need would be. And I was thinking, rather than a leadership that's piloted by sovereignty, isn't the revolution upon us in the age of YouTube and Facebook? How can we really have a revolution? What does it really mean to have a revolution unless all of us take initiative to spread awareness? Like you said, so many people don't even understand or can't understand, let alone get involved in what we're discussing. That's our job, right? I mean, is the leadership that we need really another, like, leader figure or savior figure?
I think I got the I have to tell you this. There's a bit of an echo, and I didn't catch everything you said. But what I thought I heard you say is how do we involve a lot of people in the revolution, and we don't need a savior? Those are the words that I caught from here. Do you want to?
A leader per se, shouldn't the leadership fall on all of us? On the path to a truly egalitarian society where all of us contribute to society and to the benefit of humanity, now is the time. Now we have a unique opportunity with technology to include as many people as we can and make an exponentially progressive difference.
Well, right? Okay. One, I would invite you and others to use this new technology to really... What? I'm having trouble with my mic. Okay. I would invite you, and I can talk louder also, you and other people who know this new technology to utilize that to spread revolution, to open up forums and debates, and you can check out the website of revcom.us, which is the Revolution newspaper website. The bookstore has a website. The bookstore needs a new website. You want to help get that out. So we need to use this electronic media and the new media to actually involve many more people, particularly at this moment, in starting to be debating this and talking about this. But as for the question of saviors, no, as the song says, and we want no condescending saviors. That's not our point. A savior who comes in from on high and saves people, that's not our objective. But we do, if you really stop and think about what goes in to making a revolution and to running a society, if you really think about what does it take to get, frankly, to get that food into Whole Foods. Well, maybe we won't have Whole Foods as it is now, but we're going to have a lot of food for a lot of people. You have to know some things. You have to have an understanding of how to run a society that would gradually and through leaps and bounds eliminate the need for institutionalized leadership. That is the goal of the communist revolution, to get rid of the need for institutionalized leadership. But if you really think about it, it's highly irresponsible to say, well, that really is a complex problem, and it could cause a lot of problems, so I don't want to think about it. Let's just leave the world the way it is. No, you need leadership. And the thing is, obviously, how I began tonight is my contention is we have some really fine leadership in Bob Avakian and in this new science of revolution and communism that he's developed on the foundations of what has come before with Marx, Lenin, and Mao. And I really encourage you to take a look at that, because you would find that it's a quite emancipatory and liberatory, not just goal, but actually movement, and even more, a science and methodology for getting there.
Okay. I apologize that we're running late in the evening, so I want to get another question. We have this guy in the blue sweater. Wait for the mic. No, because then it gets in the recording. Thank you.
There it is. Okay, my question or my comment is, I don't know, it feels to me like you said that inevitably we would have to have some form of leadership, somebody who organizes. We can, under the idea of everybody doing their own part, we do still need someone to put all those parts together, maybe get them in the room at the same time, to organize. So what keeps going through my mind is that's something that's inevitable. So what are you going to do as a communist with the people who are opposing your point of view? Do we put them in jail? Do we deprogram them? How do we do that?
That's a good question. Deprogram them? No. Put them in jail? That's not the answer. And not to say that there's look, you make a revolution, you run any society there for a period of time, you need that. But that, if that's the essence of what you're doing, then you're not getting to a different world. Okay? People who, there needs to be, and this is what I've been trying to bring forward, there needs to be a lot of dissent under communism. And it's true, that's not been the previous experience with this. Although I do have to say, people need to really take a close look at the Cultural Revolution in China. We did a symposium last year at NYU trying to bring out the really liberatory character of the revolution. And I have to say, there's never been a mass movement in the history of humanity that involves so many tens and hundreds of millions of people grappling and arguing over the direction of society. It was an extraordinary period in human history. But there were problems with it, I don't think we have the time to walk through all of it, but in a nutshell, it is this question of valuing dissent and having that dissent expressed by those who are the ardent advocates of these oppositional positions, themselves being able to articulate it without being prejudged in it, in the sense so that people can actually learn what's true and what's not true. And there does need to be a society, a revolution society, where there's plenty of room for civil space and private space. And you're not going to, you can't, and this is a very important thing, you can't force people to believe what they don't believe. You can try to do that, but it doesn't work, and we can sum that up, being scientific about it. But you do need to create a society where there's the best conditions for that, and that will include having to have a state that does enforce certain things. If I want to be, look at the world right now, just think about women. And what it means to walk down the street in any city in this country and see the degradation on every newsstand, to turn on the TV, to be basically see your whole life going before you as either being an object of sexual gratification for someone else that has the price of assault, the price of rape, the price of battery, or being a mother as the sole things that your life is about. We can't have a new society where the degradation of women in the form of pornography and prostitution is allowed. Those are not things that you're going to allow. Mainly you got to deal with that through methods of persuasion and education, but you're also just not going to allow it. There's not going to be prostitution in a new society. That's it. No more. You say that's coercive. I say that prostitution is very coercive, both for the people who are victims of it and everyone. What? I think the laws I think first off, just on the question of laws, and we should let other people, you do need a constitution. A constitution is very important in this new society. The constitution is something that the party itself needs to be subordinate to. You need laws. I can't say how would that law be written and how would you write it. Certainly the penalties towards prostitutes are not the point. The point more is outlawing the practice of it, and certainly people who profit from the promotion of prostitution, would need to be punished. Well, okay. Look, it would be the height of irresponsibility and almost hypocrisy for us to stigmatize women who've been caught up in all this various forms of sex industry. Even to call it an industry is really in itself an abomination. So this has to be changed. The point is not that people who were victims of this are now going to pay the price for that under a new society. The point is to change the whole thing.
Well, Well, I would...
You might want to say something about this.
No, I want to say that you should have a program at Revolution Books on the question of the sex industry, pornography, prostitution today and in the future society. I would love to be part of that discussion. But
you just volunteered.
I'm volunteering. No, but I have the unfortunate role now to tell you guys that we're winding out of time. And so I'd like to give you the opportunity to make any closing comments, anything that's to me. I know that now we've ranged quite a bit, so if you want to take a minute and think about how you'd like to leave people this evening.
Yeah, we can't, for better or worse, there's no way to wrap up the conversation. It can't be summarized. I mean, obviously the question of, you know, communism is based on the definition of communism that Andy is saying is different from what we have thought it was, I mean, as an individual, I'm quite troubled and quite almost in a state of desperation, you could say, because I don't feel I feel we're in a kind of gridlock, and I feel an awful lot of people are literally dying every day because of the system that we have, and so many others are spiritually dying because we don't allow them to be what they could be and should be. My leaning is in a more anarchistic or socialistic direction, which perhaps by definition doesn't have as much of a plan for how to achieve its ends. The danger of my tendency is that we'll be stuck with the status quo, which is, I totally agree with Andy, is a kind of criminal point of view. The fear on the other side that I would have is, you know, why them? Why should they be the ones to lead all of us into a new world? It could be them, it could be somebody else. I would rather have it somehow be all of us at once responding to our better natures, and that may be, you know, it may lead, I mean, my point of view needs a better spokesman than me to, and you know, everyone is invited to compete. I feel that the great danger of being too vague is that we honestly will stay exactly where we are, which is the if you know vague people, you know that that's the problem.
Well, I want to say I'm somebody who's over the last 25. When did Aunt Dan and Lemon first come out?
1985.
Yeah, well, I hate to say it's almost 25 years, but it is. You can't hear? Okay, can you hear now?
Yes.
All right, well, I'm going to shout then. I'm saying, look, I think your work is brave work.
You have to look for it.
Okay, so what is...
On the other side.
All right, there you go. Aha, sorry. Look, I think Wally's work is very brave work. And that's, I don't say that to flatter Wally, but because it's actually the case that this is work that calls people to look very deeply and to feel very deeply. If you've seen any of the plays or heard the readings, how the world is and how it works on people's consciousness. He calls people to not be complicit with it. I think that's very important. This is extraordinary that we've had this conversation tonight. And one thing is extraordinary in two ways, one of which is positive, which is that it's been really interesting for me. I've learned a lot from it. And another way it's extraordinary, and it shouldn't be. We need to have a lot more conversations like this. And we need a lot more people engaging how the world is and how it could be. And it's not without cost, even for somebody like Wally to come and do this. And we should recognize that. And we've got to change the climate in society where people feel like they do want to engage all this. And you know, one thing I can say is, okay, look, I'm going to tell a story. I said, well, is everybody there going to agree with you? I said, hardly. This is, you know, these are the questions that exist, and we've got to start talking about it. So while you have your vagueness about, if you will, about how do we get to a new world, the fact that this, you find this world intolerable, the fact that people have come out tonight to find out about what the questions that are posed by their disappointment in the change that didn't come, all of that's good. And let's all keep working in the different ways that we are working to bring about a different world and a better understanding of this world. And then we'll mix it up and talk about it and struggle about it. And I do hope that people come into Revolution Books and see that all the books on the shelves, but including that you engage this communism, you know? There used to be an ad that says, try it, you'll like it. I think, you know, but you should come and check it out for yourself and then let's get into it. And I just want to, well, you know, again, thank all of you for coming out and my appreciation to you. And now the discussion's opened. Now it's in your court and we're there.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming out tonight. And thank you, guys. Please do stop by the Revolution Books table on your way out, and hope to see you at Revolution Books in the future. Thanks again.